You know ID in the D in the L O A. ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID in the D in the L O A. ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 224 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Wow, hello. We've already announced the things. You can't be that excited.
That's fair. But we're going to re-announce them. And then to do that, we're going to need to toast. So let's get to what we're drinking this week. It is from our friends at Jellyfish Brewing in Georgetown.
New friends. Our new friends.
This is the first time we've had jellyfish. So we are doing the Kvike Yeah Pale Ale, the South Seattle Brewery Coalition, which is a thing that I feel like we can solidly support, has come together to showcase one unifying ingredient. Each brewery will highlight the ancient Norwegian yeast Kvike in whatever way they see fit. We've chosen to brew a light pale ale, and we've infused a slice of Washington State to our Norwegian gem with the addition of apples. The result is a flavorful pale ale with notes of soft fruit and ripe apple.
There we go. I'm pretty excited to drink this.
I don't know if I've been looking for a ripe apple note.
I've been noshing on this Kvike yeast all the time, but I'm like, somebody needs to pair it with an apple. You seem perplexed.
There was a drip off the bottom of my bottle, and I did not understand why.
Pause for you to sanitize.
Now that we're recording a video, you can tell that I'm doing this.
This was a huge mistake. You're going to be able to tell when I'm not paying attention.
Well, I already know when we're in the Sounders portion of the podcast. As a reminder, the fourth annual Peltoncast Live at Home is coming up on Friday, the 11th at 9 p.m.
The 11th, Friday the 11th.
We'll be bringing you everything you've come to expect from Peltoncast Live on the stage, though it's BYO Rainier Tallboy. I have in here, look out for more details on this year's third Pelton Brothers. We're ready to announce a few of them.
Wow.
First off, DJ Infrared will be back to
a serve Peltoncast the legend. It literally would not be Peltoncast Live without DJ Infrared. He has been through so much to get to this point. Do not disappoint him.
It's a role that only he can play. Serving is sort of heckler, sort of voice of the audience in is part of the live show. Also returning as the decider. I mean, who else could it be but to help us choose Seattle's best teriyaki, but Zach Whitman back in the role that, again, he plays better than anyone else.
There's only one decider, and it had to be Zach Whitman.
And then lastly, we're excited to welcome to the to Peltoncast Live a new third Pelton brother, Michael Sean Dugar of The Athletic Seattle,
will
be joining
go.
Us for the live pod.
Wow, we're going to be talking Seahawks on this podcast.
Yeah, they'll come up. Jeez. I was mostly planning to talk about just the canceled Pac-12 season.
Yeah.
We were actually going to run through a simulation in the most recent NCAA football game with current
NCAA
rosters.
Football 14, here we go!
of what the 2020 fall season might have looked like. That was my plan. But instead, maybe we'll talk a little Seahawks with Mike, because
all
that's
right.
Kind of his specialty.
You know what to expect from Peltoncast Live. Do not miss this. The Zoom link will be posted week of the event. It is free to the public. Come in, turn on your Zoom. We are going to party on this one. You know what to expect. Again, there's going to be surprises, special guests, excitement,
whimsy,
possibly even food.
I'm excited.
You don't want to know how we're going to do that. Drones are coming to your house.
I mean, we also maybe shouldn't promise it, because we haven't talked to the people who would be providing that food as of yet. We should probably get
whoa,
on that
whoa,
one.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Oh, man.
Also, again, as we mentioned last week, we're bringing back PeltonCast Fantasy Football. Please email us at peltoncast@gmail.com if you're interested in playing with us this season. Even if you were in the league last year, be sure to email us because we just kind of need to have that record of everyone who's going to be participating. So thanks to everyone who has already shot us an email for that one. Okay. I told you we had a surprise this week.
Oh, God.
You'll love the surprises. If I told you that there was a podcast where I got referenced featuring two professional athletes, which athletes would you guess those were?
Two professional athletes?
Yes.
I'm assuming it wasn't the Greg Olson podcast.
No, it's safe to say it was not that. Shouts to Greg Olson.
I'm trying to think of people who actually have podcasts. I mean...
Well, there's one very obvious person who has a podcast.
Third Pelton brother, Jage.
Yes.
Who is Jage talking?
Someone that J.J. Redick talks to that I know have interviewed many, many times.
Sue Bird?
That's correct.
Wow.
Let's play the audio.
That's really interesting. So Kevin Pelton, who writes for ESPN.
Yeah, Kevin's a Seattle guy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He is a Seattle guy. You know, he does all the advanced stuff and the analytics, really thoughtful stuff. And whenever he does his projections for team wins and player performance at the beginning of the year, he factors in player movement. So if a player goes to a new team, then his expected, you know, win share is decreased because of that movement. So there is some, I think, some historical context to this.
Look at that. J.J. Redick. Come on the pod.
I mean, more than that, J.J. Redick, on the off chance you're listening, we would love to be part of the podcast network you're starting, along with your own pod, The Old Man and the Three. So please get at us, J.J.
J.J. Redick, buy the pod.
I mean, I'm not expecting him to pay anything for it. Let's be realistic here.
Okay. We're fine with whatever deal. In fact, we would pay to be on the J.J. Redick podcast network.
I don't know if we'd go that far. Appreciate the listener, Matthew Hollister, for giving me a heads up on that one because I was a little behind on my podcast listening, watching 10 hours of basketball last week, but I did manage to finally get to it last weekend. So that was very fun to hear. Next up, a toast to the Seattle Kraken's analytics department, which placed three members on the Athletic NHL's 40 under 40. Did I say 44-40 in the notes? That's not what it is. 40 under 40 list done by Craig Custance. Alex Mandrickey came in at number 4 on that list. Namita Nandakumar, who the Kraken hired away from the Philadelphia Eagles, came in at number 22. And then Danny Chu, who is noted in that article, they beat out several other organizations across multiple leagues to hire when he graduated from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, came in number 35 on the list.
Wow. There's a bidding war for Danny Chu.
For sure.
There we go. Well, look at the Seattle Kraken, the 40-40 club, Seattle Kraken on the screen.
There you go. Well done.
And then finally, can't believe that we have to do this again, to both Jacob Blake and then everybody protesting in Kenosha, that they're able to stay safe out there during those protests and recover from being a victim of police violence.
Yeah, and find a way to get justice for him. So, all right, do we have a Seattle food update this week? I don't think we do. I guess we were going to follow up on cookies. This is not a Seattle food update, but our just ongoing cookie discussion. The famous Cousin Katie did get cookies delivered from Milk Bar, and you got them delivered, and then you never delivered them to me. So I have not gotten any cookies.
You're in desperate need of cookies. Here's the thing. If you cared enough about the cookies, you would have driven to my house to get them.
Oh, I'm sorry. There was only, again, the 10 hours of basketball on every day.
Okay, I forgot your cookies. That's fine. I'll drive you cookies tomorrow. But here's what I do have to say. I want you to have had them, recently to be able to report back on this time?
Not just recently. I've never had the cookies at Milk Bar at all. I've always the soft serve and then the cake truffles.
Those cake balls, they're incredible. We got chocolate cake balls this time. Have you ever had those before?
I have not, so I'm very intrigued.
Wow. They're maybe even better than the birthday cake ones. They're a little bit more brownie-like.
That is high praise. Also, it should be noted, we did conduct a draft for these cookies because there was six varieties and four each between you, me, and Mrs. Fantasy Genius. So we had to figure out who was going to get which cookies.
Well, we initially tried to do some sort of complicated plan of ranking your favorites, which you couldn't come up with.
I mean, it just didn't work out evenly. It's not that I couldn't come up with it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just couldn't run enough regressions on it or whatever.
And that every time I tried to do it, it favored me. And so I felt that was unfair since I was the one doing it.
You came up worse in the cookie draft.
Compared to that, yes.
I do have to say, though, after getting the Milk Bar variety of cookies, that's really no competition for Bell's cookies.
Wow.
The thing is, we're eating Bell's fresh every time.
Right.
They're like...
sometimes so fresh that you're eating four cookies immediately once you get them.
There's a big difference between eating cookies fresh out of the oven that day and having them shipped to you from wherever the Milk Bar cookies ship from. So, like, they have an advantage just to begin with. If you packaged up... you know, the person we need to ask about this didn't talk about you on a podcast this week, but it's Brianna Stewart.
Because she got them shipped to her in Florida.
Across the country. Then we'd be comparing them cookies to cookies.
So we need to send her Milk Bar, is what you're saying. That definitely wouldn't seem weird at all.
If she would be willing to come on the Peltoncast to talk about cookies, we would be willing to send her Milk Bar.
Oh, unquestionably.
There you go. If you're listening to this, Brianna Stewart, know that we would be willing to send you Milk Bar if you come on the podcast to talk about cookies. But it really is just like, you need to try them, because I think the cake truffles they're a unique beast unto themselves, and it's a special thing because nobody else does those, right?
Right.
But straight up cookies, I think that the varieties that Milk Bar has are very interesting, and I really think that they rate very highly as far as cookies go, but the Bell's cookies are somehow better.
You saw that they have a new Bell's cookie this week, right?
Yes. You're lucky that I didn't just get in the car and go immediately when I saw that. Although they're not open on Tuesdays, right?
I can't remember the exact schedule, but how exactly would that make me lucky? Then I would have gotten cookies.
You're actually unlucky, yes.
Extremely unlucky. The new one is Mexican hot chocolate plus churro cookie. I don't know why I added the cookie there. Plus churro.
I'm going to have to go there and spend another fucking $80 on cookies again. Oh, Lord. But it'll be worth it to drive for 120 minutes to spend $80 on a cookie because they've got Mexican hot chocolate plus churros.
I mean, you already had a several-hour trip tonight to get teriyaki. Should we talk about that?
Yes.
Okay, so last week we had our pilgrimage to the north end for teriyaki. This time we were venturing west for teriyaki as you headed out to West Seattle to
go west, young man, for teriyaki.
I mean, in general, most places you are in the country, you're going to want to go west for teriyaki. Seattle, not necessarily the case. The two spots we hit up, Nico Teriyaki and a relatively new location, I think, that we've been wanting to try since Third Pelton Brother and Talking Taco Time co-host Randy Cote posted about going there over the quarantine, Grillbird Teriyaki.
Yes. Which one should we start with?
Let's start with Nico.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I want to save Grillbird.
Okay. I'm so fascinated to hear what you have to say about Grillbird. If you're wanting to save it, I thought Nico was pretty good.
I thought it was solidly above average neighborhood teriyaki.
Mm-hmm. It was very traditional. I mean, the thing is, I got to talk about it in terms of Grillbird. That's the thing.
All right, that's fair. Like, okay, should we just start with Grillbird then?
Yeah, because it really, they were very, very different teriyakis.
And I did the grill bird first, so it kind of set the tone. I don't know what order you went in.
I kind of went back and forth. You know, I just put everything out in front of me. So we got a chicken sandwich from Grill Bird, which I think was just called the Sando. Is that correct?
Let me look it up.
Which, by the way, I'm against cutesy names for sandwiches. just to begin with, starting there. Look, you could just call it chicken sandwich. If you want to be basic, call it chicken sandwich. That's fine. But I had the sandwich
first. It's called the We Love You Sando.
We're not judging that specifically because it's not teriyaki. I thought the sandwich was quite good, though.
I don't think I was as high on the sandwich as you were.
I thought the fried was really nice, and there was flavor to it. It was basic, but it's basically like for, say, like a Korean-style chicken sandwich. I thought it definitely rated.
I could have used a little more of the sauce. They call it bird sauce. That's honey mustard. I could have used a little more of that, I thought.
Yeah, see, I didn't taste a ton of that, but it probably by the time I ate it had kind of like just dissolved into the bun in a good way. But it was like the chicken on its own was moist enough, the thigh again, was moist enough that it, I have learned that there are chicken thighs and chicken breasts and wings even too. It was moist enough and flavorful enough on its own with the fried that it was like, I don't even need sauce here.
So would you like, we've done a bunch of chicken sandwiches lately. Where would you place this in that rankings?
I think I would place this as the best of the chicken sandwiches that we've had.
Wow.
I mean, excluding Maono.
Obviously.
Maono is not part of that conversation.
Just
again,
the ones
Maono,
that we tried new in 2020.
It breaks the scale. Maono. Like, there's no curve with Maono. It's an A and everything else is an F. But
you were complaining earlier about our search for Seattle's best teriyaki.
I want to come back to that later because I feel like this all is sort of part of the same conversation. But it really, to me, starts with the Grill Bird teriyaki.
But I was saying that we're not just searching for Seattle's best teriyaki. Somehow we're searching for Seattle's best cookies unofficially, and then Seattle's second best chicken sandwich, because the number one chicken sandwich is written. It's in stone. That is known.
Yes.
I would not probably put this at the top of the ones we've had this summer. I would probably put it behind Jack's and Cookies, but ahead of the Milk Drunk.
See, I didn't have a cookie sandwich. That's the thing.
Right, you had the chicken strips from there?
Yes. Which, maybe that would change things. Milk Drunk is last for you. Wow. Our order of these chicken sandwiches is all different.
We're giving people different perspectives.
Uh-huh.
Okay, should we get into talking about the Grill Bird teriyaki?
Yes, I am so fascinated to hear what you thought about it.
So, this was definitely not at all traditional or authentic Seattle-style teriyaki.
No.
It was really fancy seeming. In fact, I had to go look it up because it was such big chunks of chicken that I questioned, in fact, whether it was the chicken breast instead of the chicken thigh. But it is a thigh. It's just a much larger one, and as opposed to, like, usually they're sliced pretty thin so that they'll cook quickly. You know, that's a lot of the logic, I think. So the chicken, it tasted more like eating chicken, if that makes sense. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
And it was pretty high quality. I would say in some ways almost in the – you don't think so. I can tell from your look. I would say in some ways it was comparable to me to the Addo teriyaki.
This was fully not my thing.
Huh.
I have to say. So there were sesame seeds all over it. It's just like visually you're like, oh, this is not chicken teriyaki. This is not what we're talking. This is not Seattle style chicken teriyaki. The flavor of it, there was no viscous sweet sauce really with it. There was a hot sauce that came with it, right?
Yeah.
Sort of like a chili sauce, which I ended up pouring on it, and even that didn't have any flavor. It was up there to me with the most bland chicken teriyaki that we've had. There was nothing to latch on to here. I even thought the rice wasn't very good, to be honest.
Are you did I maybe swipe the only sauce in there? I don't know, because our experiences were wildly different in terms of the sauce. I thought it was the single best sauce we've had.
What?
Yeah.
The single, it was so bland.
Not the one that I had. I don't know what to tell you, Chief, but...
The single best sauce we've had?
That does not describe my experience. I thought that there were two sauce cups in there, that I took one and left one for you.
No, I had a chili cup, and then I had the katsu sauce. I did not have any teriyaki sauce. I think you may have confused the katsu sort of like barbecue sauce with a teriyaki sauce.
You're saying that you think I put barbecue katsu sauce on mine?
No. I had in the bag left over the katsu sauce and then the chili oil. There was no teriyaki sauce in the bag.
I see. Okay. So I confused. I must have been the chili oil, I think. I thought the katsu, there was one that spilled in there. I assumed that was the katsu sauce.
No, there was like a chili oil with all the chilies, and it was the chili oil. And then there was the katsu sort of like barbecue style sauce.
All right. Well, I took your sauce then.
Okay.
Ruined your experience.
Maybe that's why I thought it was so bad. Okay. I'm willing to admit that. That makes more sense. Because I was going to say, I told myself I wasn't going to do this. I've got the Toshi sauce in the fridge. And I went and I was going to be like, I'm just judging these on their own. I'm not going to judge Toshi's teriyaki sauce. We know that's good. Right. I had to go get the Toshi's teriyaki sauce. For this one, it was not edible otherwise.
Man, I really loved the sauce.
I didn't have any, so I can't.
We're gonna have to send you back, I guess, is what we've learned here. I'm sorry about that I ruined your experience.
Well, it's even worse because I was gonna come in with really hot takes, and now I feel like it's incomplete.
It definitely is.
This is the downside of sharing teriyakis.
So I scored the chicken an 8. I scored the sauce a 9.5. As I said, I thought it was the best we've had. The extras got an 8 because they offer a scoop of mac salad, which I will always take the mac salad. That's a very solid thing. Love a good plate lunch. Mm-hmm. And then a 7.5 for value.
It's just, this isn't a teriyaki place.
I mean, it is a teriyaki place. It's not a Seattle-style teriyaki place.
It's almost like it shouldn't really be a competitor here. It's a different thing.
I think that's reasonable. Yeah.
Okay. I'm getting myself out of having to go there again. Because I felt like, in comparison, the Nikko teriyaki to me was excellent, right? Like, the sauce had such a glaze that it was into the chicken. Without adding anything extra, it was deep in it. It was one of those things where you're just like, I can taste the teriyaki in every bite. It is part of the chicken.
See, I don't agree because I felt that it was kind of overwhelmed by the level of char.
Oh, there was a lot of char.
It was the chariest chicken we've had in this search. And some people I know are big on the char. I'm not a char guy.
I fucking hate this search.
This is what you said earlier, yes. And I was like, look, I told you. And this is why I didn't want to search for Seattle's best teriyaki. I'm
literally
glad.
The worst search we've ever done. The only good thing about it is that we get to eat a lot of teriyaki, and all teriyaki is good.
Exactly.
There's other searches. That's bullshit. Miko teriyaki is good. Miyaka. There are other searches that we've done where there were some items that are just like, yeah, that was kind of bad or bland or whatever. Seattle-style teriyaki is always good. Every Seattle-style teriyaki place is good, and that's great. Differentiating between any of them is not good. Like, the idea that I would drive to Mill Creek for more teriyaki, I'm just like, God, kill me.
I'm going to do it. And enjoy it. I've used a lot of that sauce.
Kill the search completely right now.
Oh.
Just pick it back. Send Zach to go get cookies.
Absolutely not. Zach and I will be choosing Seattle's best teriyaki
the 11th. I suppose I have takes, but I really do not feel strongly about any of the teriyakis we've been to.
That is wild. First off, you felt strongly during the process, I feel like.
I feel like there's somewhere I'm like, okay, this is clearly not Seattle's best teriyaki, but there have been very few that I've been like, this is clearly Seattle's best teriyaki.
It'd be weird if there were a lot of them where you were like, this is clearly Seattle's best teriyaki. That would be a problem with the search.
This stands out. When we did sandwiches last year, there were certain sandwiches that you ate them and you're like, this stands out from the bunch.
For sure.
And I just don't know if anything stands out from the bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, find out September 11th, Peltcast Live. BYO Rainier.
My ratings for the Nico, 7.5 for chicken. I did not have the same fondness as you did for their sauce. I rated that a 7. I thought it was, you know, pretty average. 7 in terms of extras, and then a 7 in terms of value. So, again, a solidly above average neighborhood teriyaki shop.
If I lived in West Seattle and that was my neighborhood teriyaki, I'd be very happy about it.
Well, especially as compared to having Miyako as your neighborhood teriyaki.
Oh, God!
Should we talk about sports?
Oh, God, I'm just done talking about teriyaki. I'm not done talking about teriyaki. I would love to talk about teriyaki, but I'm done comparing teriyakis.
Fair.
I dread it every week.
It's time for our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci Pizza cannot be compared to how the Blazers have played recently.
You know, the thing about the Blazers is it feels like they've had a lot of success in the playoffs, including getting to the Western Conference Finals a year ago. But it feels like every year in the playoffs, they reach a level where they are just completely outmatched. Like, they never lose.
It's the 1-8 matchup. Like,
yeah, and
that's what it's supposed to be.
They played a ton of minutes during the seeding games and in the play-in game. This is all the things that, like, I said before the series when everyone else was like, oh, the Blazers could be dangerous for the Lakers. And game one kind of threw everyone off the scent, I think.
Yeah, 3 more to go.
Damian Lillard will not play in game 5 as the Blazers try to avoid elimination.
Do they have to play in game 5? Like,
they are obligated to play game 5. I mean, first off, every Lakers game is crucial for the NBA's TV ratings, so they're going to play it.
This is like, is there a chance, you remember the last game of last season when Anthony Simons just went off?
It was Anthony Simons and Gary Trent Jr. So they're both going to be involved in this one pretty heavily.
I think Simons is going for 60.
And sadly, Skel Labissiere is not still around to participate in this.
You know.
Wait, can I retell the story about Media Day? When I asked Anthony Simons about that game, and because it is the way it played out, you'll recall, the fact that the Blazers won that game made them the 3 seed instead of the 4 seed. They played Oklahoma City in the first round. They played Denver in the second round. It set up their entire path to the Western Conference Finals. The fact that all their reserves won that game, that they were probably trying to lose.
Yes.
Like, real talk. And so, you know, I ask Anthony Simons about this at Media Day, and he kind of deflects it at first, and then he's like, "Look, some people say it changed the course of NBA history, but I don't know about that." That was basically what he said. It's great.
That's you talking about you appearing on the JJ Redick podcast. Like, you know, some people were saying changed the course of podcasting history. I don't know. Can't say for sure.
So hopefully we get a game for like that out of Anthony Simons.
That's what's coming. It's just really tough to watch. No, honestly, it's like a completely different team than played game one or in the playing games.
They just look really, really tired right now, especially poor Jusuf Nurkić.
It's really tough. The other thing is that it just feels like this happens to the Blazers. I mean, it's exactly what happened in the Western Conference Finals last year, and I think...
Not exactly, because they were close in every single game in the Western Conference Finals last year, and they have been very much not close in 2 of the 3 losses so far this year, and I'm not liking their odds in Game 5.
Yeah, they got swept, but they were close in every game.
Which, friend of the pod, I'm sorry, third Pelton brother, Nate Duncan, coined earlier this week as the McMillan sweep, because his teams have an unfortunate tendency to be on the wrong end of those particular series.
Ouch.
In Indiana.
The McMillan sweep, ouch.
I mean, there are worse things, like you're not getting embarrassed swept, but you are getting swept.
Look, carrying a ragtag group of underdogs to the number 3 seed in the Western Conference Finals, push the Spurs to Game 6. Thank you, Mr. Duncan.
He's not saying that that's old.
We'll always have 2006.
2005? We will not have 2006.
We'll also have 2005, too. I don't know if I think that the Blazers' entire roster needs an overhaul. They just need to get healthier. They need not a summer of rest anymore. You know, they need a solid fall of rest. And come back
maybe,
at it
maybe
again.
Maybe winter, too, is based on the current estimates for when the season is going to start.
A spring 2022 of rest. But
they need, like, a small forward. Like, literally anyone who plays small forward, because they don't have anyone who does that now. Maybe Hezonja.
And I really believe in their ability to go find veteran depth. You know, like, the roster kind of fell apart this year. They spent way too much time trying to replace Nurk. And they spent way too many resources trying to replace Nurk, and I think in a lot of ways gutted their roster because of it. Knowing confidently that you'll have Nurk back next year, Zach Collins back next year, that's going to change things. Obviously, Simons being a year older, Gary Trent being a year older, like, there are a lot of positives still for the Blazers. Getting CJ healthy, you know, it just felt like all year CJ wasn't CJ. And I think this team will be back and be a solid middle-of-the-road playoff team next season.
We're just doing the off-season preview now? Would you like me to get into it?
I mean, really.
Okay. I mean, they'll have about three...
By this time next week, we're not going to want to talk about the Blazers.
This is fair. They're going to have about $30 million under the luxury tax, assuming it comes in at the same level as this year is projected. And so your options for that are they'll have their mid-level exception, the non-taxpayer version this time around. You'll be able to use the biannual exception, which they used 2 years ago to sign Seth Curry to what was a bargain deal in hindsight. And then your other options are either re-signing Hassan Whiteside using his bird rights, or I see a head shake there, or you deciding to bring back Trevor Ariza at his $12.8 million salary for next season.
Feels like a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but I like the fact that you only have so many avenues to add players to the team, I feel like that still might be the right decision. If you do that and then use the mid-level on, you know, some sort of a combo big man who can provide you insurance for Nurkic and Collins.
Okay, let's say it's the mock offseason right now. Who is it? I have granted you your wish, and the 10 hours a day of basketball that you have to watch are over.
Look, I'm just wanting to let's get it to a nice, reasonable 5 hours. Tonight was great. Loved it.
Who is this MLA big man?
See, I'm going to need to do this on the fly as I wait for the spreadsheet load. I can look at the free agent big men on the market this year. This was kind of a spot that when we did the mock offseason, I filled by trading for Cody Zeller. So that's how I was thinking of doing it. But he is not, as it turns out, a free agent. So it will not be him.
Okay, so we've got confidently not Cody Zeller.
Nerlens Noel, like the mid-level, would be too rich for him. But I'm a big Nerlens Noel fan.
I am. Are you? Do they need a backup
center,
though?
It's true. The problem for you is that Collins is a backup five.
He doesn't space the floor.
I mean, neither...
You don't think floor spacing and shooting is a factor at all?
It's just the first name I came up with. I'm trying to look at the list here. All right, Enes Kanter could be a free agent.
Run it back.
Nikola... No, he's got a player option. He's not a free agent. Tristan Thompson... Also not a shooter.
Hate all of these options. They do need.
Speaking of returns, Mason Plumlee.
The Blazers are going to go 0-82 next year and take it all back.
At some point, I'm going to find a big man who can shoot as a free agent this summer, this fall, winter, whenever free agency occurs. Let's see here.
They don't exist.
the other return, Myers Leonard. You wanted a shooter.
A
shooter.
Lord help me.
Marvin Williams. He's more of a pure four.
Oh. Isn't Big Marv going to get paid, though?
No. Certainly not more than the non-taxpayer mid-level.
All right, I like that one.
Derek Favors, we'll see what his market looks like. He's probably going to want a starting spot, though.
Let's bring Marv back home.
Ish. Aaron Baines, who actually is a shooter now. Aaron Baines would be fun. Enjoy that. Yeah, these are not the most exciting options I've ever come up with.
Blazers offseason.
I don't know. I thought my sense looking a little better as I go through that list. Because I think Serge Ibaka is probably out of their price range. He would be awesome if they could get him. Yeah. Don't love those options. But it's okay. I've got several months until I need to figure this out for the mock off season.
I got time. Okay. Well, might as well just break it all up. I take it all back and just blow up the team. See what they can get for Dwight Howard. You know, I heard that the Warriors are shopping that number 2 pick.
I mean, this is for... Oh, you know, actually... You know, actually, has had an amazing playoff run. Jeff Green.
That? Yeah. You know, I like,
now that
I
he's
like
a,
Jeff Green.
He's a setter now, for that. So it works.
Oh, man. Well, it was still... I was going to say it was a fun season for the Blazers. It actually wasn't. It was a pretty bad season.
It wasn't a fun
whole.
Season for anyone. It was interrupted by a pandemic.
Yeah. It was a fun play into the playoffs for the Blazers.
It was a fun 2 weeks, yes.
The bubble Blazers really had it there for a second.
I mean, there honestly was a question in one of our 5-on-5s. Is Damian Lillard the best player in the NBA right now? You can't take that away.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you'll never be able to take that away from him. But, you know, we'll see what happens in this Game 5, but I think we know what's going to happen.
I have a pretty good feeling. Let's turn our attention to Seattle sports, starting with the Kraken, who, in addition to having several members of their front office honored, opened their team store at Chandler's Cove on Lake Union in the location of the former Joey restaurant last week.
Wow. The ghost of Sark haunts the Kraken team store.
I don't know if that particular Joey location was the one he frequented.
What was the? Where would he have frequented?
Well, they had
Joey?
Not opened the U Village one up yet, but I think on the east side. I think it was actually Sark.
Oh, he was going over to the east side.
I think he probably lived over there.
You couldn't have just left it at the ghost of Sark haunts the Seattle Kraken team store. You had to be technical about it. Look, let's just say Coach Sark probably made it to a lot of Joey restaurants.
He probably didn't limit himself to just one, yes.
He wasn't discriminatory about which one he was going to. Oh, man.
Trips there will be by reservation only to ensure social distancing. So there you go.
Okay.
Am I safe in assuming no M's hot takes? Remember when you committed to doing them all season long? I'm pretty sure you did.
I was like, there's 60 games. Fuck it.
They're halfway through those. And already the steam has been lost. But the Mariners did have a 3-game winning streak over the weekend, sweeping the Texas Rangers.
There we go.
And then on Monday, extended that to 4. Or on Tuesday, extended that to 4 with their win over the San Diego Padres. An 8-3 victory there.
Now that's what I call a winning streak.
They have moved out of the AL West cellar and improved their playoff odds to better than 1%. Maybe even...
There we go. I mean, they beat freaking Slam Diego.
They're up to third now in the AL West. They passed Texas in addition to the LA Angels. They're ahead of both of those teams in run differential and the Boston Red Sox, who are having an extremely terrible season. So they are fourth from the bottom now. Through the midway point, Kyle Lewis, the clear team MVP, before Tuesday night's game, a 368, 456, 585 slash line.
There we go. He's over 1,000.
Led the AL in both on base percentage and offensive WAR, was fifth in total WAR. This is the BaseballReference.com version, and fourth in OPS.
I don't know why you had that team MVP in there and not just clear MVP slash line.
You know,
right
they
now.
Don't tend to give MVP awards to players on teams that are 7 games below 500 through 31 games.
4 in a row.
Like, if they come back and make the playoffs, then maybe it happens.
Man, you're making me with this. This should have been a hot take because I'm thinking about watching baseball.
There you go.
Tomorrow.
That is a hot take. Well,
I didn't realize they were playing Slam Diego too. I get to see Fernando Tatis Jr. versus Kyle Lewis. Like, that's baseball of the future right there.
What rule will he break next? That feels like the intro.
Days of Our Lives.
No, no, it's a drama about a rogue. I mean, you get a rogue investigator, I guess.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Not caught.
Not anymore.
A rogue.
Read the room.
Firefighter.
Read the room. The Seattle Sounders are back in action and got a big win
there
on Sunday. 3-0 over the rival Portland Timbers in Portland. I would say they silenced the Portland crowd, but, you know, that already happened. The pandemic did that.
They were silenced. That's right. This isn't the MLS's back tournament anymore. This is MLS second half action. And you know what that means for the
Sounders. It is time for them to start peaking. They got a brace from Raul Diaz in a match that was scoreless much of the way. The third goal by Kelvin Leerdam, set up by Rui Diaz just to rub it in against the Timbers. Got much better shots with 2.4 expected goals to 0.6 for the Timbers, according to the 538 Soccer Power Index model, even though the Timbers had the better of possession in this match. So, all in all, a very encouraging performance by a Sounders team that got back Joel Paulo, got back Yaimar Gomez Andrade, two guys who had missed time during the MLS's back tournament, was close to a full-strength squad. They did miss. They were without starting center back Javier Arriaga after he suffered a quad strain in practice, but I wouldn't say I was missing his penchant for dramatic misplays and red cards, etc.
Wouldn't say I've been missing Javier Arriaga. well, have fun with your trophy, yeah. Portland.
That fake trophy. So the downside of trying to watch the Mariners tomorrow is the Sounders are back in action because the games are coming fast and furious during this restarted MLS regular season. Tomorrow night they'll be hosting, or tomorrow night as we record this, possibly today or possibly even yesterday or maybe several days before that as you listen to this. Wednesday night they'll be taking on
the 11th or the 12th, depending on where you are.
Podcast time zones. Wednesday they will be taking on the LA Galaxy at 8 p.m. On then Sunday it is the other LA squad, LAFC, in a showdown, a rematch of MLS's back tournament mismatch, but also more famously last year's Western Conference final. That one's going to be nationally televised again on FS1 on Sunday night at 7 p.m. Sounders up to a tie for second in the Western Conference standings with 11 points, putting them ahead of both of the LA teams. The Galaxy got a shocking 2-0 win in El Tráfico on Saturday after entering with just 2 points from their first 5 matches between the MLS regular season in the group stage of the MLS's back tournament. It's been kind of a sluggish start to 2020 for LAFC, which, after beating the Sounders in the MLS's back tournament, then got knocked out in the quarterfinals. They're currently tied for 5th in the West with 9 points, and they saw star Carlos Vela leave the Galaxy match with an MCL sprain, which is expected to sideline him in the next 4 to 6 weeks, so it'll rule him out for next Sunday's match. Vela did not participate in the MLS's back tournament, with prolific veteran striker Bradley Wright Phillips taking his spot. Clearly.
It's not a bad
backup. And LAFC did not seem to miss him in that 4-1 victory over the Sounders. So, you know, hopefully that quad strain does not heal real soon for Javier. I mean, I want him to stay healthy, but maybe not for that one. The Seattle area's other pro soccer team, OL Reign, will be back in action. The NWSL on Tuesday officially announced the, quote, fall series, which will run from September 5th through October 17th with a weekly game on CBS, plus additional matches on CBS Sports Network, some on CBS All Access. Teams will play two matches each against the other teams in the regional pod, which, as reported last week, includes the Portland Thorns and the Utah Royals in the West with OL Lorraine. That schedule will be announced next week.
This is what I'm talking about. Games on CBS, CBS yeah. Sports Network.
Also, there's going to be a WNBA game on CBS next week, which is a first in league history.
How do they have the rights for that?
They have games on CBS Sports Network, so... Yeah, so there'll be games both on Saturday, both on ABC and CBS.
Wow. What is this? The NFL in the 90s?
Let's turn our attention to the WNBA and the Storm, which, when we last recorded this podcast, they were flying high, setting all sorts of records for point differential, one loss on the season, and then hit a rough patch. Starting with Sue Bird being ruled out due to a recurrence of, you know, pain and from the bone bruise she suffered in her left knee several weeks ago. So she has missed now each of the last three games. And head coach Gary Kloppenberg said before tonight's game that the medical staff expects her to miss a few more games before she returns to the lineup. So her return's still not imminent, certainly not encouraging, because now the Storm seem badly to need her at the offensive end. Last Thursday, they suffered a 90-84 loss against a young Indiana Fever squad that's been very good offensively but has struggled defensively this season. Saturday followed that up with an 82-74 loss to the Las Vegas Aces, the number two team in the league. A game that, for much of the time, was not that close. Storm made a late run to make it interesting, but couldn't completely close the gap. And then finally got 2 days off. This was a part of it, along with Sue Bird's absence, is they'd played every other day for about 3 weeks there as part of this.
A lot of Storm games lately.
It's part of this WNBA schedule where the games are coming, much like an MLS, coming quickly as they try to get through the season. So they had a full day off for the first time in several weeks. Were able to throw a baby shower for Sammy Whitcomb, whose wife is expecting, and a gender reveal of their baby. So that was very cool. And then after that, on Tuesday, got back on stride with an 87-74 win over Indiana, with Brianna Stewart just really controlling that game at both ends. 27 points, 9 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 blocks, 4 steals for Stewie in this one.
There we go. It's getting back on track. It's a get in the car, we're going shopping type performance by Brianna Stewart. The game on Saturday against Las Vegas, it really felt like Las Vegas was kind of hitting everything. The defense looked sluggish, and the Storm were just missing open shots. And I think that must have something to do with the exhaustion that they were feeling. So hopefully having a little bit of time off has given them a chance to reset. This isn't the type of season where, given the pace of these games happening and how heavy the schedule is, nobody's going to dominate in that same sort of way. But I think having an opportunity to come back and play Las Vegas again is huge.
Yeah, so the Storm 7 of 26 from three-point range in that game. Jewel Lloyd shot 1 of 11 from the field and, you know, had some good looks in there, just couldn't get anything to go down. So a frustrating afternoon, but like you said, a chance to avenge that pretty quickly, just like they got against Indiana. They will play Vegas on Thursday on CBS Sports. Then Saturday, they face the Chicago Sky on ABC, the aforementioned ABC game at 11 a.m. Pacific on Saturday. And then after that, they'll have a three-day break, their longest of the entire regular season. Yeah.
Huge.
So the Storm, with that win, heading into the Aces game, still atop the WNBA standings at 12-3, a half game ahead of the Aces. That one really looms large then, because not only does Las Vegas have a chance to go ahead in the race for number one with a victory, it would also give Las Vegas a sweep of the season series in the head-to-head tiebreaker. So you want to make sure that that stays 1-1, I think, that season series, and give yourself a little bit more breathing room. Storm still clear far and away number one in the WNBA in point differential at plus 12.3 points per game. The Aces second at plus 8.4 points per game.
Okay, putting up some Bucks numbers.
Let's move to UW sports and some men's basketball news. Some disappointing news that the Huskies got last week on the recruiting front is highly coveted recruit Paolo Banchero, part of the 2021 class, committed to Duke. Cool. I mean, you hope that UW had a pretty good chance since, you know, both of his parents were athletes at UW. His mother, Rhonda Smith, is one of the great women's basketball players in Husky history. But the lure of, you know, the big time program and kind of the track record, I think, of Duke players in the draft, I'm sure were big factors in him making that decision.
And UW players in the draft don't fare well.
Yeah, they get drafted pretty high. After that, it doesn't always go so well.
But just, whatever. Fine. Go to Duke.
I mean, he has the right to go wherever he wants. That's an important thing here. Player empowerment. Remember, you were big on that 2 weeks ago.
No, I don't care. It's just, it's fine. If you have the opportunity to go play basketball at Duke, you should do that. Is he going to be guaranteed to start for them from day one?
I think there's a pretty good chance of it.
It's just, he's too good.
He's very good, yeah.
It's like, he happens to be from Seattle. Both of his parents played UW sports, but he got too good. It's like, you always want somebody to be at a comfortable level of good when you're in the UW basketball program. You don't want them to be so good that they're going to start at Duke, because it's like, look, if you could start at Duke, you probably should.
Yeah, I mean, they have won some of those recruiting battles. You think about Duke versus North Carolina for John Brockman versus Duke for Spencer Hawes, but you're not going to win all of them, that's for sure.
But it's just like, I do think it is different for those players, too.
It was a different era back then.
When Paul is going to be probably a one-and-done player, Duke.
I mean, Spencer Hawes was, but yes. Also, who knows if he'll end up playing basketball, Duke? That's a long ways from now, and a lot of guys don't play college basketball now, as it turns out.
What is the era, or what is the year that they're supposed to be, the having to spend a year at college is going to be repealed?
I mean, I think the talk at one point was of the 2022 draft, but maybe it's later than that now, so, yeah, I don't know.
It's whatever year Bronny can come into the NBA. That was the first year. LeBron James made the rule. I mean,
now the Players Association and the league have some bigger issues to hash out in terms of the salary cap and what they do with the lost revenue this year. So that's probably not on the front burner anymore. In happier UW basketball news, John Rothstein of CBS Sports reported that Kwadi Green has regained his academic eligibility for the upcoming season, assuming there is one. He also reported that the Huskies have requested transfer waivers for immediate eligibility for Cole Bajuma and Eric Stevenson, who transferred here this year. I think the fact that they were coming home, you know, during the midst of a pandemic probably gives them a pretty good chance of getting those waivers, is my read of the situation. But you never know with the NCAA.
Oh, the NCAA is just good people.
You never know with the NCAA.
You know, I the thing that I think of when I think of the NCAA is player-centric.
I think of rational.
Uh-huh.
Consistent.
They like... they like looking at what's in the best interest of the player. And that's what they really
I'm
like
sorry, they're
to
called
do.
Student-athletes.
So, sorry. Student-athletes, yes.
Which is weird when none of the other students are on campus because all the courses are online. But the players are still there. I thought they were just like all the other students. Huh.
I mean, it's honestly better.
Oh, yeah.
Than,
I mean,
but
it's
like,
way better. Yes.
But no, it's great to have Claudia back. I mean, this still is looking like there's a lot of things to figure out for this upcoming Husky basketball season, but having Kwadi there is going to be huge, and I think he's going to be a focal point of what they're doing should the basketball season happen.
Agreed. They still don't have a replacement for him, which was the big issue last season. On the football front, the NCAA has approved the same changes for fall athletes as they previously adopted for spring athletes, which is this year will not count as a year of eligibility, and then scholarships for players who would have exhausted their eligibility will not next year count against the scholarship limits. So, you know, anyone who wants to, again, will be able to return. Teams will be allowed to exceed the scholarship limit to keep them on scholarship, although you're not necessarily obligated to do so. But the Huskies UW Athletic Department previously announced that they would do so for the spring athletes, and I assume that they will make every effort to do so with fall athletes as well, despite the massive financial challenges of this lost season. And then four-star tight end Jack Yeary, who committed to USC in February over UW, has instead enrolled at UW and is now listed on the Huskies roster.
I kind of snuck that one in.
I mean, there was a wolf on it, so it wasn't completely sneaky in it.
There was a wolf on it. Okay, so here's a question for you. Are we concerned at all? Let's say that the ACC, the SEC, the AAC, or whatever, go forward with this doomed college football season, right? Big 12. Is there any concern that athletes from the Big Ten and the Pac-12, who are wisely making the decision to not play sports this fall, are going to want to transfer to institutions that are playing sports?
Yes, I mean, we've seen a couple of Wazoo players put their name in the transfer portal in the last couple of weeks here. So I think it's definitely a concern. We saw a UCLA grad transfer today who transferred to Baylor. But
did he transfer? Is he there instantly and going to play in 2 weeks?
Are they starting that early?
Or whatever, this season?
Yes. Is it because he's a grad transfer?
Like okay, so that's a pretty unique circumstance. But if I'm Landry Fields or whatever, I can't just up and transfer to wherever in the Big 12.
If you're who?
Who's the quarterback for Ohio State? JT Fields?
I should know this, but Landry Fields is, you know, he's scouting for someone in the NBA, so I'm pretty sure he's not transferring anyway. Justin?
Brian Day? No.
Yeah,
Justin Fields is right. Okay, so, wow, their running back's name is Master Teague. There we go. If I'm Justin Fields,
you
know I can't
when
just
you watch video of him. Master
what?
Teague Theater. It's so nice to have the visual of this.
If I'm Justin Fields, I can't just up and transfer to Baylor and be playing mid-September or whatever.
I don't think so, no.
Okay, because that really is, it concerns me as something long-term, that basically because these institutions are willing to risk the health of their players and their students by playing this college football season, that they're going to end up farther ahead in the sport in general. I mean, it was interesting to me to see the top 25 rankings that still included Pac-12 and Big Ten teams. Or it's like, are you going to have a top 25 that doesn't include the Pac-12 and the Big Ten at some point?
I don't know. We'll see. It's all unprecedented.
It's very strange. I mean, I was a little bit like, are these, you know, like, what's, how do you do this? How do you, if you're trying to have the system that is probably ineffectively judging teams throughout these conferences who never play each other, and now you're going to have part of it is, the teams aren't even playing games, some of them. Like,
well,
how are you possibly going to do that?
Just because those conferences are playing games doesn't mean all the teams are going to play games. I don't know if you saw the headline that Texas Tech continuing to practice despite 21 active cases.
They're going to play. That's the thing. They don't care. Every
At some point, other teams
see
are going to refuse to play. If you've got Ooh. That many cases on your roster, other teams are not going to let you play them.
We'll see. I've seen no steam. I've seen steams from institutions deciding that they don't, you know, Notre Dame says that they want their classes on, is pivoting to classes online, right? It does not affect football. And it all comes down to money. Like those 20 players from Texas Tech who've tested positive, they don't care, right? It's an unfortunate circumstance for them, but it will not set them back in this goal of playing football right now. They cannot wait for
the
spring.
Oh, but the advances in testing have dramatically changed things. All the players are going to be safe now. Let's turn our attention to the Seahawks, who, as we discussed on the Talkin' Taco, we have not mentioned the Talkin' Taco time is back, in case you didn't catch that in your PeltonCast feed. We had additional content with Pat Cashman talking about his Taco Time Northwest ads and some updates on getting Taco Time during a pandemic. But one of the things we discussed is that we will not be getting Taco Time at Seahawks games this year at CenturyLink Field. They announced that they'll play their first three games without fans, and your response was...
Some breaking news that they're going to play their last five games without fans also. Or more. Hopefully more.
Nothing is changing between now and week seven of the NFL season that all of a sudden we're going to jump from phase two of our reopening, which we have remained at since, I don't know, early June? We're looking at a solid 2.5-3 months here in phase two. Not much sign of phase three or phase four on the horizon.
It is kind of interesting that teams are announcing this game by game rather than the entire year, right? Like, this is what Adam Schefter is going to be reporting on.
Well, he'll have, that on top of the usual roster news. The team traveled to CenturyLink Field Saturday for a mock game / scrimmage, which was cut short after defensive end Brandon Jackson was knocked unconscious by a helmet-to-helmet collision with Cedric Ogbuehi and left on a stretcher. Certainly a scary moment that, again, they decided not to come back from, but Jackson back at team meetings this week, though not yet back practicing on the field. So glad to hear that, you know, he was able to avoid any serious injury.
Just a fun reminder that football, even when not in a pandemic, is still dangerous.
The offense here appeared ahead of the...
Fun year so far.
The offense appeared ahead of the defense based on the stats the Seahawks published from this scrimmage, with Russell Wilson completing 8 of his 13 pass attempts and Geno Smith going a perfect 8 for 8.
Let Geno cook.
The offense scored on all three drives they ran before the Jackson injury. A touchdown for the first team offense, a touchdown
Brock Heward
and a field goal for the second team offense, and then the first team offense was driving again at the time of that injury.
Interesting. I feel like the reports that we've gotten from camp in general have been that the defense is kind of generally ahead of the offense, and that the defense has meshed really well and is playing very well. So I feel like... Who knows? I mean, like, you're playing scrimmages against yourself. That's the thing. Like, it's going to be so hard to judge. But you know what? It would be hard to judge even if there were preseason games. And anything until there are real games is going to be difficult to really understand how any team stacks up against each other. But it has felt like all the reports that we're getting so far from training camp have been generally very positive about this defense.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like really the last couple of days since this scrimmage, it's been... You know, Jamal Adams making plays, how well the defense is playing. So, yeah.
Jamal Adams is injured.
Wait, what?
You didn't see this news? His hand was wrapped today. No explanation.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't seem serious. And also, if you're a safety and you have a hand injury, it's like, oh, okay. You know, you could probably play through that.
Yeah, that's not the worst thing in the world. Should we talk about some other safeties?
But there wasn't. It really has been the last few days.
Seattle area safeties with Seattle ties have been in the news, starting with Earl Thomas, who was released by the Baltimore Ravens after an altercation in practice last week. It's funny because we talk a lot about, like, Pete Carroll managing players. You don't think of Earl Thomas as part of that group? And for him to be released by the Ravens after a season where he played well and they had the best record in the league is just difficult to understand.
Yeah. There's really something going on here with Earl. And it feels like the last 2 or 3 years for Earl have been kind of a struggle, both on and off the field. It's been kind of incredible. But to see... There was talk that the Ravens sort of leadership group were the ones that really led this decision making. Obviously, it ultimately comes down to the front office, but it felt like this wasn't something, you know, when Earl was with the Seahawks, it felt like he had the support of the team. And in Baltimore, the sense that we got, at least from this training camp, was not that he had the support from that Ravens team in the same way that he once had. And I thought that that was quite shocking.
Yeah. I mean, and again, like, it wasn't like this was a free agent deal gone sour and they're just like, look, let's cut our losses now and take the cap hit. They're attempting to release him for cause, for which he is appealing. That's going to be a very interesting thing to see how it plays out, whether they can actually win that. I don't know what the track record is of those kind of situations, which would determine
it really feels
guaranteed
like
salary this
a
year.
Punch at practice is sort of par for the course in NFL training
like,
camp.
Like Percy Harvin was a Golden Tate or Doug. Yeah. Like The day before they won the Super Bowl. Like really? Clearly it wasn't just this incident. Clearly it was a pattern of things, but it's difficult to swear with the Earl Thomas in Seattle.
Could potentially use the off-season stuff.
Yeah. But again, I don't know that that's going to allow you to cut a player.
But I do feel like a punch in training camp against your team, a fight breaking out or whatever, is pretty business as usual for an NFL team.
Yeah.
Many people would say that they like to see that. So... we'll see. It's been a strange journey for Earl Thomas. That's future Cowboy.
Apparently not. The report is that they're not interested anymore.
Man, I'm be very fascinated. Just don't sign with the 49ers, Earl. Please don't sign with the 49ers. Oh, you know what's coming, right?
The other safety in the news, UW product Buda Baker, who signed a reported 4-year, $59 million extension with the Arizona Cardinals, setting a new record for largest contract for a safety in terms of annual value, one that will soon be broken by Jamal Adams.
Did Buda Baker rank in the NFL 100?
I mean, he wasn't a running back, so he was number 97.
That is, I mean, look, the NFL 100 is bullshit. It doesn't matter. This was, and then you're talking about his Pro Bowls. It was like one of the Pro Bowls that he made as a special teams player. Like, let's just be honest here. He made the Pro Bowl as a rookie, but it wasn't as a safety. This was a shocking contract.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Hey. And that market, especially in such unprecedented times, with regards to the salary cap, that they were willing to pay a safety that much money. Clearly, the Cardinals value Buda very highly, and the Seahawks should have drafted Buda Baker when they had the chance.
Yes, this was an opportunity for many people to revisit the decision-making that the Seahawks made in the 2017 draft that just did not work out.
You got to trust in the front office.
Because they've made poor draft picks. That's why you have to trust in the front office.
Yeah, you got to trust them because they make bad draft picks. On an individual player level, the front office has been pretty uniformly, like they've had some hits or whatever, but just like kind of without logic a lot of the way, right? I mean, I know the talk when the Seahawks didn't draft Buda Baker, it was partially like maybe they were covered at safety, or they just the previous year drafted two safeties, right? This was the year after they drafted Tedrick and Delano Hill.
I don't remember the timeline anymore.
But it's just like they've had some hits.
No,
during
Tedrick
this time period.
And Delano Hill were in that draft.
Oh, so they chose Tedrick Thompson and Delano Hill instead of Buda Baker.
Much later, Tedrick went in the fourth round. He just went ahead of George Kittle. Oh no!
Who was the rest of that Seahawks draft after McDowell?
Let's take a look here.
Oh God, I don't even
235 was Malik McDowell. 258 Ethan Poser. 390 was Shaquille Griffin. Which obviously a lot of people are unhappy about not taking Kevin King, and there they did get better value. 395 was Lano Hill, 3102 Nas Jones, 3106 Amara Darboh, 4111 Tedrick Thompson.
It's the freaking Darbo draft. Oh,
they did get Chris
God.
Carson in the seventh round.
Right. Wow. Okay. And the, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Good. This is the bad drafting that you have to trust in them because of. Oh man, maybe they should have traded all these draft picks for Jamal Adams.
I mean, hindsight is always 20/20, but there was a lot of people. You were probably much more on the Buda Baker bandwagon than I was at this point, but.
You weren't on the Buda Baker bandwagon?
I don't know if I wanted the Seahawks to necessarily invest that high of a draft pick in a safety at that point.
You just want them to invest two first-round draft picks and another high draft pick, and then also make him the highest-paid safety in NFL history.
I don't recall those two being the only options. But I was pretty good with Bradley McDougald and Quandre Diggs, as a matter of fact. It does make you wonder. I mean, obviously, we haven't seen what the guarantees look like on the Buda Baker contract. The numbers in terms of just years and salary are relatively meaningless with NFL contracts. But boy, does it make you wonder how much Jamal Adams is going to get.
Oh, man. I mean, it was incredible that Buda Baker got this contract and Jamal Adams was trending on Twitter. And part of it was just like, you all care way too much about athletes' contracts. Like, all of the people tweeting about Jamal Adams' response to this Buda Baker contract is like, this shit doesn't matter to you. Why do you care? It wasn't even Seahawks fans. It was just like, in general, NFL fans. We are way too invested in how much money athletes get paid.
Correct.
It's the same fucking thing as when people like respond about who, like between Woj and Shams. It's just like, it doesn't fucking matter. You're not responding to the information. You're responding to who reported the information. Who cares? This Buda Baker extension does not change your day.
It really doesn't, no.
God.
But anyways.
Same as Jalen Ramsey being like, you know what? My agent and the team are talking about that. That's all I have to say. Look, it's all I had to say. That's it. Why do you keep asking me the same fucking questions? I said what I had to say about it.
And now please continue reading my trade grades and analyses of free agent signings in the NBA.
No, those matter. Those
Thanks.
Matter. Oh, man.
Well.
Oh, Lord. Who are the Warriors going to trade the number two pick for?
Spoiler alert for those people who didn't read my ESPN Plus piece about it. Probably no one.
Really? Because you don't think there's a market for the pick?
It just doesn't seem like there's a lot of... It doesn't seem like there's a trade that makes a lot of sense for them to give up the number two pick and use either their trade exception or that someone would be willing to take back Andrew Wiggins as part of that trade.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking of that. It was like all of the people, all of the like discontented NBA players, like granted there's going to be more. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of big name. Bradley Beal is the one that obviously everybody is kind of circled. But if that's just not going to happen for this pick, then I just don't know who else is.
John Hollinger of The Athletic threw out Jrue Holiday if they give up both this year's number two and next year's Minnesota pick, which
is Jrue Holiday.
He also
had
them getting JJ Redick in that deal.
So, oh, Jage.
Get him to the West Coast.
Jage, come to the West Coast, Jage.
Well,
I feel like the Jrue Holiday is not worth that. I mean, it's still a pretty valuable pick. The idea that right when they got it, it was just about who are they going to trade it for? I felt like it was instant.
Yeah. It's a fun topic to talk about, but it's harder to actually construct a trade that makes sense.
Well, and like why? Like I understand trying to, you know, match the primes of players with Steph and Clay and Draymond, but why not just draft LaMelo or whomever and try to extend your team's prime?
I mean, I feel like that rarely works out as well as you hope it will, but...
They won the championship, and then they drafted Darko. They're going to be good forever.
So tried it with the number two pick for Shakina Strickland, and she's had a very nice career, but was not the next star, as it turned out. Took until Brianna Stewart got here and Joel Lloyd. Well, on that note.
Whew, thanks for listening.
Thanks.